Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the number to call, 800-462-7413. Of course, along with your call, some topics to talk about. Tell us, Zorba.
Yes, the clothes make the doctor. We'll talk about a very interesting article that was published in the journal The Atlantic and discuss that a bit. And we're going to talk about daily aspirin. Does it really prevent heart attacks? In whom does it prevent those heart attacks?
I will be interested in that one since I do take a daily low-dose aspirin. I'll be listening. What's our recipe?
Pastrami breakfast hash.
Ooh, that sounds interesting to me.
And as you know, pastrami breakfast hash might just include wonderful, delicious stuff like pastrami, which is one of my favorite things.
800-462-7413. To the phones now, Zorba, a listener in Escanaba, Michigan with us. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet. How can we help?
Well, I'm a 47-year-old woman, and I entered perimenopause about 4 years ago. I've not ever been pregnant, and I'm wondering, as I proceed through perimenopause and into my years after that, generally, are there any health concerns that I should be more or less concerned about? Am I more prone or less prone to any certain health conditions?
Well, there's one issue. We know that that because you've not been pregnant, you've had more estrogen in your lifetime than a woman who has been pregnant. Because when you're pregnant, estrogen and progesterone changes with the baby, you know, and with essentially the placenta that's there. So there's actually a somewhat increased risk for breast cancer. It's not a huge increase in risk, but there is an increased risk from what I've read for breast cancer. But getting regular mammograms really pretty much does the same thing. It's not as if we look at this risk as a high risk and say women who have not gotten pregnant have to have mammograms on a more frequent or regular basis at all. That's probably about it. There's really nothing else that I, nothing else that I can think of. How's your health otherwise?
You know, my health is good otherwise. My lab tests have all looked okay, and generally have not had really physical health concerns to worry about.
Okay.
So I feel fortunate.
And you exercise on a regular basis, or what?
I do. I do some weight bearing exercise, some weightlifting. Walking for aerobic exercise and Tai Chi for balance.
Oh, Tai Chi is great.
Tai Chi is wonderful. I really enjoy it.
How heavy are the weights?
Well, I'm up to 15-pound barbells right now.
So Tom likes to lift weights, right, Tom?
Yeah, I'm asking because ordinarily, whoever I ask lifts a whole lot more weight than I do. I'm happy to hear that 15-pound number. It makes me feel a lot better.
Tom was in the comparison mode. If you had said, yeah, you know, you're lifting 100 pounds above your head, Tom was about ready to...
Demasculate.
That's right.
I have one other question. I took oral contraceptive, a low-dose oral contraceptive, for about 10 years from my mid-20s into my mid-30s. How does that affect my future health in any way?
I don't think so at all.
Okay.
I don't think that. There really is no cumulative effect to contraceptives that really does not affect your health. So that's just perfectly fine. So stay away from smoking. Don't drink too much. Eat a Mediterranean diet and exercise every day, and life should be a long, sweet life for you.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I appreciate both of you so much.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you
so much for the call. We appreciate that. 1-800-462-7413. Get to the topic now. The clothes make the doctor. And for this topic, you have dolled up, I noticed.
Yeah, I've dolled up. That's right.
You have a nice dress shirt.
I've got a self-tie bow tie. Self-tie bow tie. A bow tie that's a click on, a clip on is not a bow tie. It's a bow.
You're a doctor, a wonderful doctor. You've had a great education.
That's right. You have
a wonderful wife.
That's right.
You've raised three, four wonderful children who are super edgy. And what you're proud of is you can tie that stupid bow tie. You don't brag up anything like you brag up your ability to tie a bow tie.
That's right. Well, I can't shoot a basket, but I can tie a bow tie.
Let's talk about it.
This is a very interesting issue. So this is an article in the Journal Atlantic. It talked about, you know, doctors, you know, often when we describe a patient, especially in residency, you say whether or not the patient is, you know, is well-groomed or disheveled. I mean, those are often in a hospital when you're describing a patient that comes in. But patients also look at doctors, and the question is, what should doctors wear? And this particular article talked about the fact that they had gone in to see a woman doctor, and she was wearing stiletto heels and a corporate-type dress. And she felt like, you know, this person was dressed up as if she were going to an office meeting. And the next time she was wearing a pullover sweater and, you know, looked completely different. And it's interesting because doctors used to have a uniform.
Yeah,
and the uniform
the
was
white
coat, you know, white jacket, white coat, tie, shirt, male. I mean, let's talk about the uniform. It was a male uniform. And when I went to medical school, we had a huge number of women in our class. In fact, it was the largest number of women ever in the University of Illinois class, 8%.
Yeah.
8% were
How
women.
Things change.
How things change.
Yeah.
And women, by the way, were discriminated against all the time. And there was no uniform for a woman. You know, what was she supposed to wear? A white coat, and was she supposed to wear heels or not heels? And it's interesting. Now, the other issue was back in England now, they've said doctors should wear short sleeves because long sleeves will breed germs, even though there's no evidence they actually spread germs, that ties should not be worn because ties then, you know, go and they go into the patient as you're leaning over in the patient. The ties will then have mucus and bacteria and stuff. And how often do you wash your ties? When was the last time you washed a tie?
Ask me what the last time was that I wore a tie.
Well, that's the other. When was the last time you wore a tie?
I'm thinking maybe 20 years ago.
For a wedding. Funeral.
Did I? I don't remember what the last occasion was.
But it was an occasion.
Time. It's been a long time.
But I occasionally wear a, you know, a tie. Today I wore a bow tie for you because I wanted to dress up for you so that you would, you know, show me the respect that a tie deserves.
And it's about time because you look slovenly.
And it looks slovenly. but the real issue is there is no one uniform that actually pleases everyone. And it's sort of like dressing for that. And it goes beyond uniform. It's also how do you address the patient? Do you say, Mr. Clark, how are you?
Yeah.
Do you say, Tom, how are you? Do you say, Thomas, how are you? In fact, Thomas might be, you know, the anyone who calls you Thomas might be your mother and no one else. And there's no, in our society,
that isn't easy, is it? I mean,
no. It's not easy. I'll look at a patient chart and I'll say, now, do I call this person Richard or do I call them Dick or do I call them Mr.? If I know them well, I know what to call them.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But sometimes I get terribly confused.
Yeah.
And then do I introduce myself as Zorba or do I introduce myself as Dr. Pastor or do I just sort of shake their hands and say, hello, how are you doing today and not do an introduction? And these things, you know, they seem small on one level. But they're the commerce of the patient interaction.
Yeah.
And being a child of the 60s, the first I hated the white coat. So when I went into clerkships in the 70s, I took my white coat and tie-dyed it, and I wore a tie-dyed white coat. So I think back to this and picture this. I'm a medical student with this long, shaggy hair and a big mustache wearing a tie-dyed white coat. What were the patients thinking I was doing?
but you were enjoying it.
I was enjoying it, and I do not have a photo of myself in that tie-dyed coat, which I have since, you know, lost away. So the clothes make the doctor, yes.
But who knows what they are? Or should, I get a kick out of it. You do a little television, and yes. Every now and then I turn it on, and you have a white doctor's coat
sometimes,
on.
Sometimes he's
having some fun with this.
Sometimes on TV I will wear a white coat. I will wear it on TV so that I look like a doctor. Look like a doctor. Feel, you know, I want people to know I don't just play a doctor on the radio. I play it on television, too.
1-800-462-7413. Toll free. 800-462-7413. And Zorba, a Billings, Montana listener, joins in now. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help?
Well, the topic you guys were just talking about is a great segue into my question, because I was going to ask, how do you shop for a doctor? I'm 28 years old. I got good health. And the last time I went into the hospital for one reason or another, the doctor asked me who my primary care physician was, and when I said I didn't have one, gently and rightly chided me and encouraged me to do that right away. And I know there are a lot of different medical philosophies on how to think about illness and treatment, and I just wanted to see if you had any ideas. If you were going to be looking for a doctor, what kind of things would you look for?
Yeah, that's a really important question, I think, Zorman. You've addressed this in the past, but not for a long time. How do you do it?
Well, first of all, the question is, you know, word of mouth. Yeah, that's the easiest way that, you know, that I say. You know,
ask
you
a
take
friend.
Somebody, ask a friend who you trust, mm-hmm. who you like, who do you go and see, how do you like them? And that often can make a big difference, because, you know, if you're in a community with different doctors, you'd like to have somebody who has the same philosophy as you have. And assuming that your friends have a similar philosophy, let's say it's a philosophy of wellness, then you'd like to go to a doctor with wellness. You may be looking for a doctor who, you know, is up on the latest technology. You may want a doctor who actually exercises, jogs, and runs, and believes in trying to do the best without medicine. But there's certain things that are going to hit you that you're going to be interested in. So that's one aspect with mm-hmm. a friend. The other aspect is, how busy are they? You know, are they in the middle of a clinic? Have they been in practice for 25 or 30 years and just don't have time, and they don't have the time that you want? You don't have to go in very often, but if you're going in for a preventive visit, and if you're 28, you don't need a preventive visit probably but once every 5 years. I mean, it's not that you have to go into a doctor every year to get a preventive visit. Even women now who meet certain criteria only need a pap test every 3 years, and that's about all you need to go in, you know, to get a pap test. If you're not on medications, you don't need to see somebody. But it's a very good idea somewhere in your 20s to go and get a preventive care visit to say, what should I be doing? So I think philosophy counts, how busy the doctor is counts, word of mouth counts. And then the other thing is, where have they been trained, and are they associated with a facility that you trust? So in other words, were they trained at a medical school that is one that you may like in your area? And do they have a hospital where you think, if you have to be hospitalized, do I want to go to that hospital? Because different hospitals have different feelings in different towns. Now, we're in Madison, Wisconsin, so we are fortunate to have great institutions. And there's some people that want to go to the university hospital because they want to have the latest in technology. Mm-hmm. And there are other people that say, I don't want to go to the university hospital because they have medical students and residents, and I don't want to have those people, you know, operate on me or see me. So there are people that choose the institution, and the doctor you choose and the institution you choose are really linked together.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. Do you have a doctor for yourself?
Of course. You know, there's an old phrase in medicine, the fool who doctors himself, the doctor who doctors himself has a fool for a doctor.
It's like the lawyer thing, too.
The lawyer, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
But I go to a doctor, and frankly, one of the problems that I have is that I can't just take a doctor's advice. On the other hand, I should really take their advice. And so it's sometimes very difficult as a physician. So when I go and see my doctor, I say, look, I'm the patient. I'm not the doctor now. What would you do? Mm-hmm. What do you recommend? Because sometimes they'll do shortcuts because they'll say, well, you know, you can do it this way or that way. And I want to be treated like everybody else.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Good luck. Come on to Madison. You can come to my office.
We appreciate the call. I like my doctor to wear bow ties.
That's very good, Tom.
800-462-7413.
I never take off my bow tie, by the way. I wear it 24/7.
Before the break, Sarva, let's take a quick listener email from John in Liberal, Missouri. He writes, Dear Dr. Zorba, I am 72 years of age and in excellent health, due in large part to listening to your great show for umpteen years. Why, oh why, do people get hiccups? On average, I get violent hiccups about once a week. I mean violent. They are so strong that each one is very loud and followed by a belch. I am concerned that I will annoy the neighbors. The nearest neighbors are a quarter mile away. I have tried all the home remedies. Nothing works. About 45 minutes or so, they just stop. Help.
Well, that's a problem. The chronic hiccupper, it actually is a problem. And
45
has to do with the phrenic nerve, and it's an irritation of the phrenic nerve, and there are medications that
The what nerve?
It's called the phrenic nerve.
P-H-R-E-N-I-C.
Where is it? In the throat? Around the diaphragm. Yeah. On the diaphragm, yeah. And so all of a sudden it gets irritated. Yeah. There are drugs we used to give. I had a patient once years ago. We're talking about 30 years ago, who had chronic hiccups.
Yeah.
And the drug that worked for him was a relative of Thorazine. Do you remember what Thorazine was?
Yeah, vaguely. No.
Thorazine was the antipsychotic drug that we would give patients so that they would – for mental institutions, for psychosis. And it turned out that drug in small doses and other drugs of that ilk would actually work in patients with chronic hiccups. It's not always an easy thing to cure. Sometimes you actually have to go and take medications every day to prevent that.
Does diet make any difference?
No, I don't think diet makes – well, sometimes some people – hot food. People hiccup with hot food, right?
Yeah.
So avoid hot food. Babies hiccup, but when babies hiccup, it's funny, right?
Yeah.
I mean, when was the last time you hiccuped?
I get it every now and then, but I only do one or two, and then
it's done. I don't get it very often. Alcohol will cause hiccups. Remember, I mean, you know, W.C. Fields. You know, you would see him, and he would hiccup because he was drunk. So certain stomach irritations will make it. Sometimes a reduction in acid will make a difference. So Zantac, over the counter Zantac, 150 milligrams twice a day, or a proton pump inhibitor such as Prilosec might make a difference. And there are some people with intractable hiccups, and that is a huge problem.
What do you mean?
It doesn't stop. They hiccup continuously. No, it doesn't stop at all. And you can't just cut this nerve. And so there are some issues with that. I have not looked at the latest treatment for intractable hiccups. And if anyone knows the latest treatment, I wonder if people know how to stop hiccups, if they'd be willing
we
to.
We talked about that. They're willing, about 97
to write our website, zorba@wpr.org. Flood the mailbox with the latest hiccup cure. That's zorba@wpr.org.
Or if you have a question for Zorba, the good doc will be sure to cough up an answer for you. Just send us that email. What?
Zorba@wpr.org. Send us all your hiccup cures. I want to make sure that Carl can sift through them so we'll keep him profitably busy.
Maybe we'll try a few on a future show. Of course, we have to hiccup first, don't we?
Well, we could fake hiccup.
Yeah, we could. Our recipe is coming up. That's next. More of your calls, of course. Another interesting medical topic to talk over, our medical mythbuster too, here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Recipe time after the recipe. More of your calls at 800-462-7413. But now, Zorba, pastrami, breakfast hash.
Yes, yes. Now, do you like pastrami?
I like it all right.
Oh, I love pastrami. I love kosher pastrami. Just one of my favorite things. I don't eat it a lot, but I happen to love pastrami. Do you like corned beef hash?
A little bit. Yeah.
Oh, I love corned beef hash. And in fact, if I'm at a restaurant, a Greasy Spoon restaurant, which I have occasionally frequented, not that often, if they have hash on the menu, I will have the hash.
Yeah.
I will have the hash. I like it. And it reminds me, my mother used to love hash. She used to make homemade hash at home, and, you know, just reminds me of my mom. Of course, every time I eat hash or pastrami with hash, I remember it's a treat, and this is one of those things you want to give yourself as a treat.
You don't think of pastrami as a breakfast food.
You don't think but it can be. It can be a breakfast.
Yeah.
So, pastrami breakfast hash. Start out with 2 tablespoonfuls of extra virgin olive oil.
2 big T extra virgin olive oil.
12 ounces of pastrami diced.
12 ounces of pastrami diced.
2 medium red bell peppers seeded and diced.
2 medium red bell peppers.
1 cup of diced yellow onion.
Cup of diced yellow onions.
1/4 teaspoon kosher salt.
1/4 little tea kosher salt.
1/4 teaspoon black pepper.
1/4 little tea black pepper.
1.5 pounds of Yukon Gold potatoes peeled with a medium dice.
1 pound of Yukon Gold potatoes peeled and medium diced.
Now,
has to be those potatoes?
Well, let's just talk about that. There's a difference in potatoes. Now, the Yukon Gold potatoes I happen to like, they're creamier and they have a different substance than Idaho potatoes. And you could use red potatoes. What are your favorite potatoes?
Red potato. Little red potatoes.
You like little red potatoes
because
you like them. Yeah. So you could use red potatoes with
them. Well,
do you like Idaho potatoes, big Idaho potatoes?
Yeah, I like them, yeah.
Yeah, but
I like potatoes. I don't even know if I've ever had a Yukon potato.
Well, it's a different potato. It's sort of like the red in that it's creamier, but, you know, it's hard to explain taste. But when you go to the grocery store next, you do a lot of the shopping, don't you?
Yes, I do.
I mean, you do. Get a little bag of Yukon Gold potatoes. They're quite good, and try them. They're quite good. And
we'd have to cook at home to do this, right?
You'd have to cook at home to do it.
Okay.
You can't buy it at the grocery store.
Okay.
And you can buy pre-made things at the grocery store. But when you bring it home in the bag, you'd have to cook at that time. And potatoes, of course, are so complex to cook, right? I mean, they're just really tough.
Okay, to the recipe.
Heat 1 tablespoonful of olive oil in a large nonstick frying pan over medium heat till it's shimmering, and then add the pastrami, bell pepper, onion, and seasoning with little salt and peppers. Cook and stir occasionally until the pastrami is lightly browned and the peppers and onions have softened. That's about 7 minutes. Then remove it, put it into a medium bowl, set it aside. Wipe the pan clean, and then under medium heat, use the another tablespoonful of olive oil and add the potatoes. Season with some salt and pepper. Cook it, stirring it until they're golden brown all over and knife tender, about 12 minutes. So you're going to basically make what my mom would call American fries versus French fries.
Right.
Versus Korean fries or German
whatever.
And then what you do is return the pastrami mixture to the pan, combine it, stir it until it's nice warm, and then serve it with a few fried eggs for a nice hearty breakfast. And it's about 350 calories for that 4 servings. So each person is getting 3 ounces of pastrami.
Yeah.
In other words, so it's not a lot of pastrami. Yeah,
I can see this as a breakfast thing. It's with the eggs and, some other kind of potatoes you put in this.
Yeah, that's right. And it's going to be a Sunday treat.
It sounds delicious, actually.
You know what? You're smiling.
Yeah.
You know something?
Yeah.
I can tell when you like food because you smile. A whole grin comes over your face and kind of angelic. You know, you can really
Well, the next time I go to a restaurant and they have pastrami breakfast hash, I'm going to get it.
You do that, Tom, because you're not going to make this recipe.
Where can I find a copy of this?
But if you want a copy of today's recipe, come on over to our website, zorbapastor.org. You can download our podcast. You can download other recipes. You can see pictures of Tom, pictures of me, all a bunch of other wonderful stuff. That's zorbapastor.org.
We get back to the phones now, Zorba, welcoming a listener in Buffalo, New York. Hi.
Hey, this is Brett.
Yeah, how can we help?
Since I was a little kid, have had weird problems with my heart rhythm where it would just randomly get thousands of beats a day. Like, I mean, I was on a monitor. Last time I was on a monitor, it was like 12 to 14,000 a day it was skipping. And it would come on, like, out of nowhere, like, once or twice a year. and it would last like a week and a half and kind of like gradually go away. But I always noticed it was like, just like come, it would literally come out of nowhere. So I spent like years and years going to different doctors, seeing cardiologists, electrophysiologists. The last time I went to see a specialist was an electrophysiologist, and he said, it looked like where my skip beats were originating from was in the part of the heart where people see ARVD, which is like that disease that athletes get. But mm-hmm. So he had me get an MRI done and do all these tests for that. Ended up coming back negative. And then I realized, and like a doctor kind of made a joke about it the last time that it happened, which was over 2 years ago now. I mentioned that I had like a weird natural, all-natural mayonnaise, is what the mayonnaise said. But it had aspartame in it. It said sugar-free. I don't know why you'd put sugar in mayonnaise anyways, but it said it had aspartame in it. And my fiance at the time made some guacamole with that mayonnaise, and I had some, and right afterwards it happened again. And then I started thinking mm-hmm. about all the times that it had happened, and it was after like I had like a sugar-free yogurt or a sugar-free iced tea, or any time there was anything that was like sugar-free with aspartame in it, I would have these flare-ups of, mm-hmm. I guess, arrhythmias. And uh-huh. it was always related to aspartame, going uh-huh. back to when I was a kid. So I've cut it out like completely, and I've had no problems in the last 2 years, uh-huh. going from like a problem at least twice a year, every year. Uh-huh. So I've talked to a doctor before, and he said, you know, he doesn't think it's related. But I'm pretty certain it's related, because mm-hmm. I mean, it's my body. So I was kind of just curious on your opinion on it.
Uh-huh. Well, first of all, you've got something unique and unusual. So I want to get back to that for a second. So when you've seen the cardiologist who was the EP, electrophysiological cardiologist, and you've had a Holter monitor, I assume that you've been monitored and looked at, did they recommend that you needed a treatment or did not need a treatment?
He said at that point, if it happened again, he would like to do an ablation. Mm-hmm. I've had ultrasounds done. I do have like a mild mitral valve regurgitation.
Okay.
But that's what they wanted to put me on medicine before, but I kind of refused medicine because it was so like rare that I would have a problem.
Sure, sure. That would make a lot of sense. You know, it's rare. Why do you want to take a medicine every day for something that rarely happens, especially if it's not life-threatening? If it's life-threatening, then that becomes a different issue. There's no evidence, you know, aspartame, you know, and I'm not it's not as if I'm a fan of aspartame. I don't own any stock in GD Cyril that doesn't exist anymore, but it made them billions of dollars because mm-hmm. they invented aspartame, which is basically divided up into two amino acids, but then there's methanol that is also derived when our body actually cleaves the aspartame to make it in our body. It's the most studied food supplement around ever, and there are websites devoted to talking about how awful it is. I think the most important thing is, since we've been consuming aspartame, we've become a heavier and heavier society. In other words, if you had diet soda, you'd expect people to lose weight, and the answer is they don't lose a pound. They don't shed a pound. They have diet soda, and they get their calories somewhere else. So I think it's pretty much a worthless thing. You know, it's just worthless. It doesn't do what people hoped it would do, which mm-hmm. is help them lose weight. Now, aspartame or anything you eat or consume, you may have a unique possibility, and there's no scientific evidence for it because, you know, it's what we call an N of one. It only affects you. So you take aspartame, you know your body. When you take it, you have all these extra beats. And so the aspartame might do that in your body, yet we may never be able to prove it scientifically because we'd have to put in, you know, tens of thousands of people on a study and actually follow them and actually say, yes, those people on aspartame actually had those extra heartbeats and those people not on aspartame didn't. So we'll never know 100%. But from your point of view, if you have noticed that you don't have the extra beats, and I would stay away from aspartame. And you bring up another great question. Why would they put aspartame in mayonnaise? That's a real question. I don't know the answer, so I would not buy that brand of mayonnaise at all. So I think you're right on. There's no scientific evidence, but that doesn't mean it's not true. It's just that nobody's going to bother doing the study because nobody's going to bother doing the study.
Okay, so I mean, it's like I'm not completely out of line for thinking
no.
that
you know, there are individual differences in our bodies that are not predictable by science because nobody has bothered to do the scientific work. You know, it's not you know, it's not the work that somebody actually wants to be engaged with. And so if you notice a difference, the real problem with food and the issue is that some people will then say, well, I'm not going to eat this because it gives me an extra heartbeat. I'm not going to eat that. I'm not going to eat this. And before you know it, they've actually pushed themselves into the fact that they're eating like 10 different foods and they're ignoring 9,999 foods. That's different. In other words, you just have to avoid aspartame. And the fact is, buy products without aspartame. It's really easy.
Yeah. It was tough because I literally went through like over a decade with just these. Like if it was one Skippy, you know, I'd be okay, but it was like 10,000 to 12,000 a day.
And well, it's
a nightmare.
That has got to be a nightmare disconcerting. And keep in mind, it may still come back, but aspartame might be one of those risk factors, and that I would stay away from.
Okay.
Take care. Thanks for your call.
800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. And before the break, Zorba, we often hear from the grammar police, but today we're going to hear from the sauerkraut police.
Oh no, it's the sauerkraut.
On a recent show, you told a caller that sauerkraut was not a good source of probiotics. Well,
I remember that.
We received a flurry of emails from listeners who were happy to set us straight on the matter. First, a listener, Christy, posted this on Facebook. I think Dr. Zorba missed the boat on this one. I'm sure he's only familiar with processed sauerkraut found in the grocery store. But fresh, unprocessed, fermented sauerkraut is a probiotic powerhouse. We also received an email from Andrew of Spirit Creek Farm, a sauerkraut producer in Cornucopia, Wisconsin, who shared this about the benefits of fresh kraut. If unpasteurized and uncooked, sauerkraut contains live lactobacilli and beneficial microbes and is rich in enzymes. The fiber and supply of probiotics improve digestion and promote the growth of healthy bowel flora, protecting against many diseases of the digestive tract.
I love it. Lucky
us.
Now, keep in mind, probiotics, the most common probiotics that we consume as consumers are the probiotics of yogurt. Yogurt is a natural probiotic.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you know, this is a great. I happen to like sauerkraut. I know it's not your favorite food. It's not on your bucket list of foods to eat.
Oh, and lucky us, lucky you anyway.
That's
you
right.
have some.
Yes.
Right
and I
have
opened.
There.
All I have opened four different jars, and I have to tell you something. You know, you can't. Radio is not smell-o-vision. Remember when you were a kid, they were talking about television that you could smell. But I've opened up these four jars, and I have to tell you, the sauerkraut fumes are simply overwhelming, and they're really good. So I'm going to try all four of these sauerkrauts. Tell you what they're like. So the first one is green-grown lactobacillus sauerkraut. I'm going to try this and see what this is like. Say, very good. Okay. The next one is lacto-fermented mustard kraut. So this one looks different.
That even sounds
It has mustard seeds. This is the one you're going to like. This is very unique.
Mm-hmm.
The next one is kimchi. I do like kimchi. Kimchi, of course, is Korean. And the Koreans, you know, ferment their kraut. Very good. Excellent. Folks, you got to try this stuff.
Yeah, what's the next one?
The next one is red purple sauerkraut. I like the color of this. Okay.
All right. So which one are you going to pass to me?
I'm going to give you the mustard kraut. You're going to love it.
Okay.
I promise you.
Yeah.
You will become a kraut eater when you eat this kraut.
Yeah. Thanks again to Spirit Creek Farm for sending
these. Thank you very much for sending these. These are delicious, absolutely delicious.
Okay, here
I
go.
And you know what? They taste different from the processed krauts.
And I'm on record not liking sauerkraut very much.
He's having the second one. He's ready to take a third one, folks. This is a very good sign.
This is really good.
You see? You took three forkfuls of sauerkraut.
I could eat the jar.
You see. See, it really is good.
We have a show to do, though.
Which one? That was the mustard. That was the mustard seed. Very unique. Wonderful sauerkraut. I stand corrected. Non-pasteurized, probiotic, naturally fermented sauerkraut is good for the body and good for the soul.
Yeah, and good for me. It really tastes good. Are you soured by something Zorba said? Just send your grievances along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have another interesting topic to talk about. That's coming up next. More of your calls, of course, and our medical myth buster. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. More of your calls coming up at 800-462-7413. After we talk, Zorba, a bit about aspirin, the daily dose of aspirin, and a new study.
Right, new study. So let's look at this particular study, and let's see if we can make some good understanding of it. So first of all, we know that aspirin is useful if you've ever have had a heart attack to prevent a second heart attack. In other words, that's not what we call primary prevention. Mm-hmm. Primary prevention is if you take aspirin before you've had a heart attack, does it keep you from having one?
Like I do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this has been a question, by the way, all along in medicine. Mm-hmm. And so this particular study, 14,000 Japanese, aged 60 to 85, followed for 5 years, no difference between the aspirin group and the group that did not take aspirin.
No difference.
Mm-hmm. No difference at all. But let's look a little bit more at the study and see what the study is. Okay. So first of all, the study was not published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. It was picked up by the news media because it was presented at the American Heart Association annual meetings in Chicago.
Okay.
So in other words, it's presented at a meeting. That means, to me, it does not have the same impact as if it goes to a jury journal where they're looking at it. You have somebody who gets up and presents the data. That's number one. Okay, mm-hmm. Bunch of people. Now, here's the most important thing. A monitoring committee stopped the study early because there were too few heart attacks and strokes for the researchers to make a statistically significant observation. You know what that means?
That doesn't really mean anything.
It means it doesn't really mean anything. In other words, there weren't enough heart attacks and strokes in either group to be able to make the statistics to say there was a difference between taking the aspirin and not taking the aspirin.
Why
did they present it?
Yeah.
That exactly is the point. Well, because they spent a lot of money. They followed all these people for all these years, you know, for 5 years, 14,000 Japanese. But in the end, there was no statistical difference between the aspirin group and the not. But there weren't enough heart attacks and strokes to be able to draw a statistically significant conclusion. And yet this was picked up at the media, and the media blasts out, aspirin doesn't cause a reduction in heart attacks as primary prevention.
Yeah, but you do say that it isn't really clear whether this
been clear for a while because we don't have enough people who have been on a study long enough to make the primary prevention.
They always say at the end of talking about something like this, ask your doctor.
Yeah, ask your doctor.
So I'm going to ask my doctor. Should I keep taking this?
Yeah, I would still take aspirin. That's what I would do. Absolutely. I take an aspirin a day as primary prevention. I've never had a heart attack. But once again, I find it interesting because it's presented as gospel. It's presented as this indeed is the case. When in fact, this is a very interesting study presented at a meeting that is not statistically significant.
800-462-7413, our toll-free number. 800-462-7413. And Zorba, we welcome a listener now in St. Augustine, Florida. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You bet. How can we help?
Well, I have an 11-month-old son, and he's recently been diagnosed with bilateral vocal cord paralysis. This condition has his vocal cords paralyzed in an almost closed position, and
wow.
It affects his breathing. He has noisy stridor breathing, which is very high-pitched squeaking, and it also causes him to choke when he eats. So my question is, has Dr. Zorba ever seen this condition in a child, and what does it look like for a toddler or older child if they're able to eat and drink normally and they can do physical activity like a normal kid would?
Let's go back. So when did this happen? How old was your child when it occurred?
Well, when he was born, he had the stridor breathing, and they said it was laryngomalacia. And that went away at 3 months. And then at about 10 months, he's 11 and a half months now, it came back. And so we went to an ENT specialist, and then they did a scope and saw that the vocal cords weren't moving. They did testing. They did an MRI to see if it was something with the brain, and they did a scope, and they can't figure out why.
Well, I'll tell you what I would do. So, you know, I'm not sure what caused this or what can be done. But if it were my child, I'd want to go get a second opinion as to what's going on here. In other words, that's what I would do. I'd say MRI, good step. You look down there and you say, yes, the vocal cords are paralyzed in some way, good step. My question is, okay, why? Why is this happening? So I then, and what I would do is I would go to either a major clinic or a university site, especially a university that has high-powered specialists who specialize in a bunch of things like this, and then I would bring my child in to be seen. And the way I would do it, I often go when I look for a site for specialty care, in something like this, I would go to a university, like I said, or I'd go to a place, a Mayo Clinic type place, you know, a major clinic where there are lots of ENT docs who specialize in pediatric ENT. That's what I would go to. So the way to find it out is you call up, you look at a university site nearby, and you call up and you say, I have a child with this problem. It's a pediatric ENT problem. Do you have any who specialize in pediatric ENT? They've then had subspecialty fellowships, most likely, or an interest in this, and that's where I would go. Because this clearly is a long-term issue, and the question is there something you should be doing about this now? And what's causing this? What's causing the fact that it's that you've got this paralysis? So I wouldn't stop until I had an answer. That's what I would. And you don't. And you clearly don't have an answer now. And your doc was good with the initial workup, but without an answer, you have got to go somewhere else to get an answer. Got to figure it out. How big is the town that you're in?
It's pretty small, but I went up to Jacksonville, which is a much bigger city, and we went to a pediatric ENT specialist there. She's the one who ordered the MRI and the scope.
Was that at Mayo Clinic or?
No, it was at Wolfson's and Moore's. Not sure.
Yeah. So I think I would go over to Mayo Clinic. They're good. They're in Jacksonville. I'd go over there because they look, what you want is you want to have people who don't see a lot these things and, you know, may see more of these things. So they're more likely to do it. I'd get another opinion. I'd go up to Mayo Clinic. I know it's up there. I know they're a great institution. And I would say, what's the etiology? More importantly, you also need information as to how do we progress from here? Because if he's got, vocal cord paralysis, the question is, what do you do with speech and speech therapy at this point and at other points? Because that's the other issue, is communication.
Right. And at this point, they're just saying, wait it out and see if it gets better. But I'm afraid, maybe he's aspirating. And so.
Well, the question is, wait it out, what does that mean? In other words, does wait it out mean a month, 6 months,
that
a year?
Like awful.
I mean, it's just not, it wouldn't be complete enough for me. I would like to know step by step, what do I do? How do I follow it up? Who do I go to? How do I know when my child is suffering? I think if he were aspirating, you would know because he would be getting pneumonias, frankly. If he was aspirating, he'd be getting chest infections. So I don't think aspiration, you would know if he had aspiration because he'd be suffering. He'd have some infection. The question is, what is waited out and what does that mean? How often does this happen? And what's the recovery period? What should I expect? There's a whole bunch of educational things. Your child is not the only child to have this.
Right.
That we know for sure. So the question is, what do you do and what do you know? And you just need more education. And frankly, you need to go somewhere else to get that.
Okay, will do. Sounds like a plan.
Thanks. Thanks for calling. Let us know what goes on. We'd be very interested. Yeah. And good luck to you.
800-462-7413. And Zorba, time again now for our Medical Mythbusters segment. Today's question comes to us from a listener named Judith. She writes, "Dear Zorba, when I was in college, I was nearly struck by lightning. It struck the ground about a step behind me. Since then, I stop watches, both analog and digital, when I wear them on my wrist.
Wait. She stops watches?
It gets better. I deplete metal jewelry that touches my skin. And I have stopped tucking pencils behind my ear since I discovered that I am removing the paint. I generate
pencils.
A lot of static. You wouldn't believe the size of my visible sparks. When I tried a magnetic bracelet, it felt like my arm was being pulled apart.
Oh.
So my question is, can a person's magnetic field be changed? I have adapted my behavior to avoid absorbing metals and paints, but is there anything else I should do? Love the show and the recipes. You and Tom are delightful.
Well, I liked the last part. I think we're delightful, too, at times. Well, here's the question.
Have you ever heard of any of this?
Never. Not at all. Now, somebody who's magnetized, if they stood out there, it would be like something in a sci-fi movie where all of a sudden all the metal in the house would go towards them. We don't really have magnetic fields. I mean, we do have iron within us, but we're not magnets. You know, we don't have magnetic fields. People who have been hit by lightning do... talk about neurological changes that occur with them because they've been hit by lightning. But I've never heard of anything like this. This is sort of like Dr. Mesmer and mesmerizing people.
I'm assuming Judith isn't putting us on with this.
Well, I don't know. I've never met Judith. Have you met Judith?
No.
No, so we don't really know whether or not. I don't think Judith wrote the question and put us on. But the real question is, first of all, I don't wear a pencil behind my ear anymore. I stopped doing that in elementary school. And I don't know why a pencil would be what the ink would have to do or the
wood. The losing paint, I think, on the like the yellow paint on the pencil.
Yeah, but why would you lose paint on the back of the pencil unless you chewed pencils? I used to chew pencils when I was. But that's it. So the answer is no, we don't have a magnetic field. So your magnetic field can't be altered because you really don't have a magnetic field to speak of.
These things are kind of inexplicable.
These things are inexplicable. And you know something? Sometimes there are things that occur in the world that are inexplicable.
Have a polarizing question for Zorba? Just send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
1-800-462-7413. 800-462-7413. And Zorba, a Rhinelander, Wisconsin listener, joins in now. Hi.
Hi, this is Bill from Rhinelander calling, and it's a follow-up call I had with you and Dr. Zorba a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was concerning my 3.5-year-old grandson, James. Mm-hmm. At that time, he was not talking. He was just saying, you know, a very few words, and he kind of did signs for what he wanted to say and what he, you know, what he was thinking. Well, Dr. Zorba, you asked if he had some hearing and some other tests done, and I did respond that he did have it done. And you said not to worry at that time, that some kids move slower than others. Well, I got to tell both of you, you can't stop that kid from talking now. he is talking so well. He talks soft. His words are very distinct. He asks questions. I'll tell you, it is just really, really great. And, you know, when I called in, I was a little concerned. But when I got done talking both to Tom and to Dr. Zorba, myself and our family, we felt very relieved because we didn't know which way to go. By the way, Dr. Zorba, you had told me a story about a 4-year-old that wasn't talking.
Right.
He was in the car with his parents, and a situation occurred. All of a sudden, he blotted out. What was she blank thinking?
That's exactly it.
That had a little bit of light, you know, to the situation.
Oh,
but,
there was that.
Again, as the gal said from Escanaba, you know, it's great to have you two on. Your program, I think, is excellent. It provides a great asset to public radio, and it certainly gives our listeners, including myself, just really great relief. And I'll tell you, it's great to have you.
You're so kind. And this was just in 3 months that it was such a difference with the talking?
Oh, yes. And it really wasn't very gradual. I mean, it just started one day and just continued.
Huh. Well, that just goes to the show. All you have to do is call Zorba, and whatever it is, will go away in 3 months. Is that a guarantee?
That's a guarantee.
I agree. But like I said, it really put us more at ease, talking to both of you. So I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, and thanks a lot for the call. 800-462-7413.
You know, Tom, this is the variation on the old joke, take two aspirin and call me in the morning.
Sort of, yeah. 800-462-7413. Our phone number, 800-462-7413. And before we head out, Zorba, let's take an email question from a listener named Russ in Stoughton, Wisconsin. He writes, I really enjoy your radio program. Today, I finally checked out your website, and while I had previously seen a photo of Dr. Zorba, I was totally taken aback with the photo of Tom Clark. Okay, I should look at these before I read them. All this time, my mind's eye pictured him wearing a formal blue striped suit, white shirt, and a conservative tie, and having a crew-cut hairstyle.
Oh, God.
Why that? I have no idea. Just what one conjures up while listening. Also, how long have Zorba and Tom been a team, and how exactly did they get together? How would anybody think that I wore a pinstripe
Fetterman.
Suit?
Remember Groucho Marx's buddy? Wasn't it John Fetterman or something like that?
Fetterman.
See, yeah. He wore a suit and a tie. That's it. He thought, I'm Groucho, you're Fenimore.
Boy, you go way back for your references.
Hey, it was the number one show for a whole bunch of years.
And how
on
we
TV.
Got together is a long, long story.
That's right.
Let's tell the truth.
To be continued.
I'll tell it now.
Okay.
You and my wife were chums.
That's right. We're friends.
Friends.
Right.
There was a little group of kind of weird people.
That's right. Yeah. Weird, strange.
You and Monica.
Strange, weird people. That's right.
And
the weirdos.
You maintained the friendship.
That's right.
When we were both working here at Public Radio, she said, hey, Zorba would make a good radio guy.
That's it. The rest is history.
Yeah.
The rest is history. That's right.
Have a question for the good doc? Post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org. Or don't forget, we're on Facebook.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Big Brad Colbert. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, expecting your company on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1220Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.